Welcome to take two. And again, apologies for the brevity of take one. In fact, take two might be slightly shorter than normal. This is genuinely because I have a plane to catch. Otherwise, I won't make it back at all.
Never made it back from Copenhagen.
But it also means that Mark gets a longer lunch break with three courses and a cigar afterwards.
No, I don't, because this is one of my 3-4 days.
Oh, okay, no, you don't. So because Mark isn't eating, he's just eating air and dust. That's all he's allowed, and occasionally water to rinse it all down with. So reviews to come in just a second. Dear doctors, honorary and PhD, I write to you with a story which picks up the thread of films with happy endings when stopped at the first reel. Who knew that this was going to be such a long runner? I refer you to the story of my good friend Ellie. Being a fellow film enthusiast, but unfortunately not of this parish, it befalls to me to tell her story on her behalf. Like many children growing up in the early 2000s, Ellie had a typical list of VHSs on hard rotation in her house, including Disney, Pixar, and Carrie. Yes, Carrie, Brian De Palma's skin-crawling adaptation of the Stephen King horror classic. But this version of Carrie, which Ellie and her sister watched throughout their childhoods, was not quite the Carrie most of us know. When it would get to that climactic midway point in which Carrie ascends the stage to be crowned queen of the prom under the adoring eyes of her fellow classmates, Ellie's mother would swoop in and switch off the film, claiming that was the end. So for many years, Ellie and her younger sister would watch this version of the film and assume it was always a lovely high school happy ending for young Carrie. Curiously, Ellie never seemed to question why John Travolta kills a pig within the first 30 minutes of the film for no reason. Also, in parentheses, I would have thought that opening shower sequence was that not
the opening
a little
scene,
warning
yeah.
that things aren't too Pixar and Disney? Anyway, of course, as with all great stories, the truth will out. One night, several years later, while both her parents were out, a now teenaged Ellie and her sister happened upon a late-night screening of Carrie on Channel 4. Oh, Carrie is on. Shall we watch it for old time's sake? One can only imagine the emotional whiplash which followed as their beloved high school happy ending suddenly mutates into a Boschian dive into hell. Needless to say, Ellie is now a devoted horror fan. Keep up the good work. All the best from Doug Deans. Thanks, Doug. I mean, to be honest, that kind of qualifies, but doesn't, given the shower scene at the beginning and the killing of the pig. I mean, clearly not a happy use certificate.
Yeah, and also given the fact that, to give Brian De Palma his due, there is no point in that thing when you think this is all going to work out. Or, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I mean, I think one of the things that De Palma does really well with that film is that you know which way this is going. That said, it is also true that the poster for Carrie was the most unbelievable plot spoiler, because the poster for Carrie said, if you have a taste for terror, take Carrie to the party. And it was a picture of, on the one side, Sissy Spacek, you know, within the dress, holding the flowers with the crown. And on the other side, a picture of her drenched absolutely from head to foot in blood.
Right.
You know, doing scary eye stuff. So, hard to imagine watching that and thinking that that was the end.
If you have a film or a similar experience, which was fine up until maybe halfway through when your parents sent it off, correspondence@kerbedemeo.com. Right, so lots of movies that are out that we haven't covered this week. What else do we go and see?
Ruby Gilman, Teenage Kraken, which is the new DreamWorks animation directed by Kirk D'Amico and with Farron Pearl. Voice cast includes Toni Collette and Jane Fonda, so fairly starry. So she is a teenager, lives in this oceanside place. She's approaching the prom on the subject of Carrie. She's too shy to ask the guy she likes, but also she has a secret. Her secret is she's been told by her mother that she can't ever go into the water. And the prom is going to happen on a boat, and so that is going near the water. And the reason she can't is because they are a family of krakens, and, you know, so therefore stay away from the water because they're trying to pass as humans on the land. However, inevitably, the water and Ruby meet. Her true nature is revealed. Her true kraken nature is revealed. This isn't a plot spoiler because it's literally in the title of the film. And, you know, in mythologically, Kraken are generally regarded as bad, as monstrous, as, you know, terrifying things from the deep that snap up sailors and do, you know. But, I mean, that's why all those nutball Trump supporters, when they kept saying, oh, the Kraken wakes, because they're terrible people, and anything that they do would indeed be terrible. But this movie argues that actually the Kraken are the good guys. The bad guys are the mermaids, which is a, you know, not so sly swipe at other animated franchises. But when her nature is revealed, she is reconnected with her grandmother, played by Jane Fonda, who is welcoming her back into the fold. Here's a clip.
You're special, Ruby. You feel it in the core of your being. Let me teach you.
But my mom told me that if I stay out of the ocean, I won't turn into
a giant kraken? You are not a human who turns into a kraken. You're a kraken hiding as a human. Once you know what you're capable of, you'll want to be the next Kraken Queen. It's your birthright. And fight as you might, fight as you will, you can never outswim your destiny.
So in a way, this is kind of similar to Turning Red, in which the central character turned into a giant red panda and it managed to deal with things like, you know, menstruation and coming of age. Or if you think about a film like Luca, in which there were people on land hiding their fish nature, which was also a story about, you know, it was a coming out story and an acceptance of different story. This is the same thing. It's like, yes, people are different. People come in, you know, many different shapes and sizes and forms, and, you know, and we're all part of the same circle of life. There is a very funny joke at the beginning when she's talking about hiding her difference, and she says, yes, you know, we tried to fit in, and somebody points at her and says, she's blue, and she says, I'm Canadian. And they go, oh, okay, that makes sense. So every time she does anything that's considered to be at all out of the ordinary, she says, well, I'm Canadian. And they all go, okay, well, that's absolutely fine. I thought it was sparky. I like the visuals. I like the way it looked. There are, you know, a couple of nice gags in it. It's got a kind of family-friendly, punky edge. And again, it's essentially a story about be who you are, accept yourself, and embrace difference. So
are you saying that people are people? So why should it be that
people are people? So why should it be?
People are people. So why should it be you and I get along so awfully? So we're different colors and we're different creeds and different people have different needs. Are you saying that, Mark, basically?
I'm saying I'm Canadian.
All right. I thought you were being all Depeche Mode just for a moment.
Did you want to be at that Depeche Mode gig?
Yeah.
You're kind of talking about it a lot.
It was kind of tempting, really. Because yeah,
you're a fan, aren't you? You like
their
music.
Good. And, you know, they were very close. Hey, I didn't have a ticket, but, you know, I could have smiled and said...
You could have got up and said, I'm Radio Simon Mayo. And I Greatest Hits is here in the house.
I did do their album launch in 1994. Would you let me in? And just seen how it went.
Didn't you say, am I misremembering that when you did their album launch in 1994, they were in a state of advanced refreshment?
You could say that. And Dave Gunn said to me a couple of months ago, he didn't remember a single thing of the of that particular album launch.
Wow. Anyway. David Bowie once said of Station to Station, because this was during David Bowie's period of taking a bunch of stuff that wasn't good for him. He said, Station to Station was recorded in Los Angeles. I know this because I read it in a book.
Excellent. We got loads of emails, but loads of films to get to as well. Tell us something else that's fabulous.
Wham, which is a documentary about Wham on Netflix. It's essentially the story of the band made with archive footage and audio recordings. Here is a flavour of it.
We met when I was 11 and Andrew was 12.
And there was only ever one thing that I wanted to do.
You get so
be in a band with George.
Andrew changed my life in exactly the way someone needed to change my life if I was going to be a pop star.
And that was it. Wham!
I mean, your record has been slagged in the press.
Slagged, yeah. It knocked George. People weren't taking him seriously as a songwriter.
Pop became a very dirty word.
Whilst I was happy being in a band, George needed more.
So the story of the band told from the earliest days of them, you know, being school friends, organized around the scrapbooks, a mother's scrapbook of, you know, of the success of the young ones, which is kind of nice. Andrew and Yogg, as he was then referred to, they met at school. Andrew turns out to have been the outgoing one. George Michael was the sort of shy one whose life was changed by meeting Andrew Ridgeley. It was Ridgeley who started the first band that they were doing together. It's a ska band. We hear a cassette tape of them playing. Then there's early demos of Wham Rap, and there's the story of them signing to Inner-Vision. Now, weirdly enough, I have that original Inner-Vision Wham Rap. I remember buying it. I remember hearing about it and being told, oh, you know, it's political pop. Because it's, you know, it's singing about the DH, you know, the being on the dole and benefits, but it's a pop record. And I've still got a copy of that. I remember thinking, wow, this is great. Of course, wasn't a hit. Then Young Guns Go For It was a hit. Then Wham Rap came back afterwards and became a hit. They got their break on Top of the Pops, apparently, like, same as Rubettes, because somebody else pulled out and suddenly there was a slot. And the next thing is they're on it and they're doing these dance routines that they've been learning in the front room. And they're the next week, they're pop stars. So the film follows the highlights of their career, many of which I had forgotten about. But as soon as you saw it, you go, oh, yes, I remember. They toured China. That was a really, really big deal. I remember that being a really big deal at the time. There's all the stuff about, you know, the sportswear and the shuttlecocks. The thing that's really fascinating about it is, you know, there's that old joke about, you know, what's the connection between Eric Clapton and Andrew Ridgeley? Neither of them played on a Wham record. And one of the things that the documentary does is it addresses head on what role Andrew Ridgeley had in Wham, because as Wham's recordings became more and more, you know, bigger productions, Ridgeley had less and less to do. And so there was always this kind of thing about Wham is basically George Michael and this other bloke. But what the documentary does is it clearly puts Andrew Ridgeley's role in the band right at the center. We hear from George Michael so many times saying the whole thing happened because of Andrew Ridgeley. We hear about, you know, him being musically important. The thing I didn't know at all, and in fact, weirdly enough, this is kind of one story which encapsulates the whole story, is the story of Careless Whisper. That Andrew Ridgeley wrote the chords for Careless Whisper. It was originally worked up as a Wham record. Then George Michael went off, recorded a version of it with Jerry Wexler, which he didn't like, and came back. They recorded it again. Michael took over the production, got in umpteen saxophone players, and finally it gets released as a solo single. You know, it's some territories it's George Michael and Wham, and in other territories it's just George Michael. And in that weird kind of thing, there is almost the story of what happened, that something that absolutely began as a collaboration ends up being a kind of George Michael thing. But I think that what this really does is it tells you what an important role Andrew Ridgeley played in their success, how much he was responsible for the image of the band, the way the band presented itself, the way that George Michael was able to present itself. I mean, obviously, as the documentary goes on, we hear about him and his sexuality and worries about whether or not to come out and how the public would react and how his family would react. But all the way through, it is absolutely clear that central to Wham's success is the combination of George Michael and Andrew Ridgeley. And I think there's really moving stuff in it, that they were, you know, they were childhood friends. They clearly just, they met each other and something clicked and it changed both their lives. And, you know, after having bought Wham Rap, I kind of thought, oh, well, this is pop music now. And then I'll just go off and listen to Red Wedge stuff. And I was probably very sniffy about it. And I remember when I was in a band at university and we needed a drummer, and Steve Hiscock was the drummer. And I said, okay, Steve, well, here's the thing. I'm really interested in like Comsite Angels and all that sort of thing. Who do you like? And Steve said, I love Wham. And I remember thinking at the time, wow, that's weird, but because they were brilliant pop songs. Yeah, and I think that this absolutely does a lot of setting the record straight in terms of that they were pop songs that were created by, but whether or not, you know, whatever instrument Andrew Ridgeley was or wasn't actually playing on a record at any time, he was at least 50% of why that band was successful.
Is this a cinema event, really? I mean, it sounds like a TV documentary.
Yeah, streaming. Yeah, streaming services, Netflix. Yeah.
On the subject of Top of the Pops, making people, just bear in mind that there are some, there's a particular story of a band I remember who I used to follow a lot called After the Fire, who had their debut hit was called One Rule for You, okay?
Right.
They got called in to do Top of the Pops. He got to, I think he was number 40 or something like that, right? They turn up, they do Top of the Pops, they film it, they think, this is it, this is going to be great, we're on, we've done Top of the Pops. Because of Wimbledon overrunning, they cut one song from Top of the Pops, which was After the Fire. So their,
no.
Yes. So their debut appearance, which would have made them superstars or just more popular, was... So imagine that. Imagine the crushing disappointment after the fever high of having done the show.
Well, the reason that the Roubettes became famous, what, because they didn't exist as a band, and Sugar Baby Love was recorded by a bunch of session musicians, including some people who ended up being in the Roubettes. The song started charting, and Sparks got pulled at the last moment because the Top of the Pops thought that Sparks were British. And when they discovered that Sparks were American, there is a whole different work visa thing that they had to jump through. So they were pulled, and with something like 24 hours to go, the record was Polydor, had to pull together a band, including some people who had sung on that session and some people who hadn't. And then they were on Top of the Pops the next day. And then 3 weeks later, they were number one.
Didn't trouble Sparks, who had toured and carried on. And, you know, had a fantastic sellout tour. In fact, they're still on it, I think.
And who just played at Glastonbury, where, as you probably saw, Cate Blanchett got up and did the dance in the suit.
Sheldon in Hastings, New Zealand. Mark and Simon, 46 seconds in on the latest show, I had to stop to listen to All Mod Cons by The Jam, an album I know like the back of my hand. And then Setting Suns, an album I know not at all. My conclusion, this is because we were discussing which is the finer of the two. My conclusion, and how is it possible to know All Mod Cons and not have heard Setting Suns? Anyway, my conclusion is that All Mod Cons is a perfect album, but Setting Suns is the more interesting album. As a Bowie obsessive, I'd compare it to Station to Station, his best album, and Lodger, my favorite album. I love them both, but I'd rather listen to Lodger. I can tell Setting Suns is going to become a favorite for me, so thanks for introducing me to it. For a film podcast, you sure are a pretty good music podcast. Where was I? Oh, yeah, back to the show. Anyway, a music podcast that can't play you any music, but anyway, we can still talk about it.
Okay, this is a fascinating thing. Setting Suns was the more successful album because that's it's Eaton Rifles, isn't it? And that's the straight in at number one. I just listened to both of them just again. I'm listening to a lot of The Jam at the moment. I still think that All Mod Cons is more perfect. But that comparison between Station to Station and Lodger is kind of, I would say it's the comparison that I would make is between Station to Station and Low, because I think that Low is a better album than Station to Station, but I've probably listened to Station to Station more.
Correspondence at KermitMayo.com, should you wish to surprisingly continue. What else is out? What else have we got?
So a documentary called My Extinction, which is the latest film from Josh Opinionasi. 2006, he made Song of Songs, which is this micro-budget feature set in the London's Orthodox Jewish community. Natalie Prest is a very devout young woman who's trying to bring her son back into the fold because their mother is dying. He also then directed The Infidel. You remember The Infidel, which was written by David Baddiel, starred Omid Jalili. I think that Omid Jalili came on our show when that film came out. It's actually a really, really good film. 2018, he made a really odd movie called Female Human Animal, which I did an intro for on BFI Player, and I went back and watched it again. I go, that film is really, really strange. And then he made this documentary, The New Man, which is a documentary about him and his wife, Devorah, as expectant parents. In 2023, he made Husbands, which is similarly self-reflexive. Now, this new film, which is kind of the third part of that self-reflexive trilogy, this is a documentary that finds him now as a father, becalmed in his career, dealing with the fallout of COVID, somehow almost accidentally becoming involved in climate activism. The film is described in its own publicity as a portrait of a self-interested, ineffectual dad who starts to panic about environmental breakdown and ends up getting far more involved in climate work than he ever thought possible. So what happens is we see him going along to meetings, going on marches. At first, he's an outsider. He's kind of, he's detached. And then, you know, he then starts holding forth about climate change, but there's very much this kind of, is he in it or is he above it? Here's a clip.
Like, what a lovely bunch of people, really nice, normal, diverse range of people who are just concerned about, you know, climate and all that. And of course we should be concerned about climate, and I am concerned about climate, but it's just like, I don't know, the whole group thing is so, for me. I'm just not a groupy, group joining guy. They're really nice, and it's just, could I be part of something like that? Is that the best use of my resources? Like, I know there are, you know, probably other things I could be doing, you know,
like
that might
be
more effective.
What other things could you be doing?
I don't know, like, well, by the way, you're not exactly, like, leaping at the chance to avert the climate apocalypse here, can I just say?
I know.
You know,
I should. I just tell myself I've got too many plates already spinning, I've got a lot on.
Yeah, me too. I've just got so much going on and just too much
No,
work.
But I mean, you know, I've got a job.
I love that. Yeah, no, but I've got a job. And all the things that she's got going on is that she's actually looking after everything else. Now, the thing to remember about this is that although this has the appearance of a documentary, it is essentially the central people in the documentary playing versions of themselves. One of the things that Josh Pignonese does is he puts himself on screen in a consistently unflattering light. And there's one point in which, you know, he says, you know, he's not quite sure about how to deal with all this. And she says to him, the thing is, you've always portrayed yourself as essentially selfish and essentially somebody who is self-obsessed. And therefore, it's hard for anyone to get on board with the idea that you might be doing this for other reasons. And I think that if you see a film, like a, you know, a documentary that somebody has made about themselves and they don't come out of the documentary well, you have to remember that's that person deliberately putting an unflattering portrait of themselves on screen, which is, you know, a kind of, it is a self-effacing, self-reflexive thing to do. So here, what you end up seeing is somebody who, almost against their better judgment and certainly against their will, somebody who is, you know, obsessed with themselves and obsessed with their life, at least in this portrait, starts to realize that there is something bigger going on and actually they should get involved and they should start to do things. There's a lovely line in which we see him getting offered a gig to do a piece for an oil company. And he's trying to justify doing it. He says, well, if I don't do it, somebody else will do it. And they're saying, yeah, but you really can't do this. You can't merely do things. What he says is, it's talking about his kids. He says, I just don't want them to hate me as we all drown. So it's in that phrase is kind of the, you know, I don't really want to do anything, but I'd like my kids not to think that I didn't just absolutely just let the planet burn. And anyway, the film is released in cinemas nationwide. And then there's, you know, you can seek it out. It's called My Extinction. I thought it was really rather engaging because what it does is it does end up talking about climate activism and, you know, which is a really big and important subject, but doing it in a way which is kind of enfolded in this sort of slightly fictional construction of somebody who is completely self-obsessed and completely interested only in their own life. But through that, we get drawn into it too. And I thought it worked well. It's called My Extinction.
Okay, well, we're going to do one frame back. So this week, as we mentioned earlier, it's films with scene-stealing sidekicks inspired because of Indiana Toby Jones. And how would you just remind us who Toby Jones is playing in the new Indiana Jones
film?
So
he plays Prof Basil, and he is Indy's old friend who, in the sequence in World War II, is there with him trying to get their hands on the Dial of Destiny, which then drives him to madness.
And he's the father of Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
Jonathan Root is suggested. So these are your suggestions for other scene-stealing sidekicks. Jonathan Root, Jason Statham in Spy. He always makes me laugh in this film every time I see it.
Get the face off machine. Get the face off machine.
Kathy H. Got to vote for Peter Falk in The Great Race. Push the button, Max. In fact, the Peter Falk voice is going to be the same. Go on, do that one.
Yeah, it is. Push. just one more thing, madam.
That's right. See, same thing.
That's the terrible
Tom, it's the Tom Waits. It's the Tom Waits voice. Yeah. Andrew Dite has got to be Short Round, especially if we're talking Indiana Jones. Rob Locock is going for Danny and Hot Fuzz. Craig Pickup says, Curtis Armstrong in Risky Business, if only for the line, I don't believe this. I've got a trig midterm tomorrow and I'm being chased by Guido the Killer Pimp. Which is not bad. I probably didn't do it justice. Mark Hoogland, Cameron Fry, because he adds soul and depth to FBDO. Duncan Beagley, after much deliberation and consideration, I'd have to go with Sadness in Inside Out.
Oh, that's an interesting choice.
Andy Martin, Dennis Caleb McCoy. Death was a fun sidekick in the main to the main duo, but this guy stole every scene and elevated the hysterics. Dano says Steve Zahn in Sahara. And Chris McEwen, Benicio del Toro as attorney, Dr. Gonzo in Fear and Loathing, medicated to the very edges of insanity. Love it.
I'll tell you an interesting story about that. So when Benicio del Toro playing, you know, Johnny Depp's sidekick in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and what Gilliam said about, Terry Gilliam said about making that film was, he said the hardest thing about it was that Johnny Depp's performance is very angular and poised, and is very much based on the illustrations that came with the book of Fear and Loathing. He said, and Johnny Depp, you'd do three takes and he would do the same thing in a very kind of, you know, because he was very into mime and he loved Buster Keaton and all that stuff. And he would do the same thing in every take. And Benicio del Toro would never do the same thing twice. So you'd have three different takes with one person doing exactly the same thing and another person like literally not doing the same thing at all. So it made editing it a complete nightmare. I'm going to go for Jason Statham in Spy because I think that's possibly Jason Statham's best role. I think he is hilariously funny in it, and it demonstrates that he has got great comic chops and great comic timing, and he steals every scene in that film.
And is that, the whole scene stealing thing, and I'm thinking also like Alan Rickman in Robin Hood, you know.
And cancel Christmas!
Exactly. Is that a good thing? I guess it is from the audience's point of view, but scene stealing is not intended to happen, is it? From a director's point of view.
The story about Robin Hood, and how true this is, I have no idea, was that Kevin Costner demanded that the film be re-edited to play Alan Rickman down and play him up, because the way that it was preview screening when they were doing the previews was it was tracking that audiences loved it when Alan Rickman was on screen. And then every minute it was Robin Hood and Marion and all that stuff. Nobody cared anymore. I don't know whether that's true, but it's, you know, that's the kind of perfect example of he's not stealing the scene. He's just being Alan Rickman. And I, you know, much as I love Kevin Costner, and believe me, I love Tin Cup, and I think Kevin Costner in no way, I think Kevin Costner is a great screen presence, but he's not Alan Rickman.
Do you remember in that Tom Hanks interview when he was in that movie he was in with Mark Rylance, and they've got those scenes together, and then Mark Rylance does that line when Mark Rylance is the spy, he's undercover, and he says something like, "Would it help?
Would it help?" That's the recurrent line. Would it help?
And
says, you don't seem to be very nervous about this. Would it help?
Exactly. And then Hank said in the interview, he knew at that moment, I think he said something like, "There goes the Oscar," or "There goes the movie," or something, because he realized that Rylance was storming that scene. And Tom was doing, I just think it's quite interesting, the whole scene stealing thing, because a big actor doesn't want that to happen, but maybe.
Well, I'll say again on the subject of Toby Jones, because this kind of inspired this about him. You know, it's definitely his movie. The first time I ever saw Toby Jones on screen was in Orlando, in which there is a silent cutaway to three, maybe four noblemen just standing in the court. And one of them is Toby Jones. And without saying anything, he steals the whole movie out from everybody else.
Fantastic. So, but our winner is Jason Statham in Spy.
Jason Statham. Okay. Yeah.
Thanks very much for all your suggestions. Correspondence at kermanandmayer.com. Weekend watch list, weekend not list. We scoured the listings for things you may otherwise have missed, and indeed things that you should absolutely, definitely make a point of missing this weekend. It's called Weekend Watch List, Weekend Not List, and five are great and three you'll hate. That's five are great and three you'll hate. Mark is going to pick one of each, and these films are all on TV in the UK, available to stream overseas. So from the watch list, goes like this. The Invisible Man, 1933. Legend, Ready or Not. Vanishing Point, Good Vibrations, and Shutter Island. That's The Invisible Man. Oh, I see. The Invisible Man is on Legend. I thought Legend, it was Legend the movie. So that's not the movie.
Oh, right.
So I'm going to remove that from the list. The Invisible Man, Ready or Not, Vanishing Point, Good Vibrations, or Shutter Island on the watch list. What are you picking?
Well, take a wild guess out of those at what I'm going to go for.
Good Vibrations.
Yes. Good Vibrations is one of those films that fills you with joy. And it has, I think, the best, I mean, it's the story of the Undertones, and it's the story of Terry Hooley. And it has one of the best ever depictions of hearing a record on the radio. And it's when the Undertones have recorded Teenage Kicks. and they run round to Terry Hooley's house to tell him that it's being played on John Peel. And it, by the time they get round to his house, it's finished. And you hear John Peel go, "Well, that was so good, I think I'm going to play it again." Everyone goes nuts. And it, I think it's one of the great pop movie scenes in a movie I've ever seen. I love that film, and it's just so joyous and uplifting.
And it's on BBC One on Sunday at 12:20 in the morning. So that's basically late Saturday night, but into Sunday morning.
Into Sunday morning.
12:20 for Good Vibrations. Liam Daly says, "I would pick either The Invisible Man or Ready or Not, but I predict that Mark will pick Vanishing Point, which is still a very great movie. Garth Maker, with the recent passing of Barry Newman, it's got to be Vanishing Point." Pub Grundy says, "Thanks, Pub. Ready or Not is the most refreshing horror film of the last 20 years. Every time me and my missus said, this will happen, it was addressed within minutes. At no point do you get frustrated at dumb decisions. It's absolutely head and shoulders above every slasher/home invasion movie." And Roger correctly says, "Good Vibrations for me and Good Vibrations for Mark." So, Roger, thank you.
Very good.
Not List, Stuff to Hate, The Bounty Hunter from 2010, Death Wish 2, and Rocky 5. Liam Daly says, "Death Wish 2 because Cannon turned a cautionary tale of revenge that was the first movie into one of their schlock factor movies. Plus, I actually kind of like Rocky 5. Peter Keane Coburn, or Cogburn, who knows, Death Wish 2, the franchise had already jumped the shark in the original. And Alexander Zoha, or possibly Zoja, "The only reason I'm aware of Death Wish 2 is that Simon saw it on a first date with a good lady, surrounds his stone doors, and Mark did not approve." That's of the movie, not of the date, because I didn't know Mark at the time. "This makes me feel weirdly connected to the personal lives of people I've never met." Anyway, Death Wish 2 is what Alexander's picking. And what are you picking?
Well, I mean, there is only one choice. It has to be Death Wish 2, despite the Jeff Goldblum, because the thing that, I mean, it's a terrible film, and in some ways a reprehensible film, but the most majestic thing is the fact that you took The Good Lady Surramses Her Indoors to see that film, and I know The Good Lady Surramses Her Indoors. She's a really, really nice person.
Yes.
Death Wish 2 is not the kind of film that you would take somebody like The Good Lady Surramses Her Indoors
free tickets
to see. Oh, I never knew this. The tickets were free.
Yes, tickets were
How?
Free.
How?
Through Radio Nottingham. I worked for Radio Nottingham. And so, you know, we had, you know, there are many privileges working in BBC local radio, and even fewer privileges these days once management have finished hacking it to pieces. At the time, yes, free tickets. Thank you very much.
Story just gets, but I never knew that. So basically, you were the cheapest date. You took The Good Lady Surramses Her Indoors, a lovely and wonderful person, to see a terrible film because the tickets were free.
Yes, yes, that's
and
right.
And Rita, she married him.
Anyway, should you wish to, because we certainly won't be renewing those wonderful feelings. It is an ex-certificate movie. It's a Michael Winner movie. These things go together. It's on ITV4 on Friday night, so that's probably tonight, at 11:05. And if you're listening to this after Friday, you haven't missed anything, but you can go back and watch it anyway. But I wouldn't bother if I were you. Anyway,
you won't settle down on the sofa, the two of you, and go, "Oh, remember?
Look at that.
Remember? Yeah. Oh, the home invasion at the beginning.
Oh, a little bit of brutality.
Yeah.
Quite uncalled for.
Censors cut this bit. I can't even think why.
Yeah. Isn't that completely the wrong moral to draw from at the end of that film? Anyway, I hope there'll be more death wishes at the end of this. Anyway, for
reasons, there were.
Yes, as we've, as I have explained, apologies for the less than fulsome nature of this week's take two. And that is because I do need to get to a plane, which hopefully will be getting us back to London in one piece. There won't be an on-fly movie, so no chance of seeing Death Wish 2 again. But thank you very much indeed for downloading us. We will overload you in future weeks.